Welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices from today's Arizona Republic: Raymond Levere Gentry, age 91, from Scottsdale; Gary Raymond Hayes, age 90, from Chino Valley; Thomas Frederick Jones Jr., 92, from Phoenix; Maddie Larson, age 84, from Phoenix; Richard McDaniel, age 64, from Mesa; John Randall Miller, age 81, from Phoenix; and Todd Watson, age 56, from Gilbert. And we'll turn now to the business section in today's Arizona Republic. Top of the page headline: Terrorist label risks higher business costs. Gangs in Brazil are the latest groups to get that designation. The U.S. designation of Brazil's biggest criminal groups as foreign terrorist organizations, starting June 5th, is likely to increase the risks and costs of doing business in a country where gangs have had years to penetrate the formal economy. The two biggest Brazilian crime syndicates, the Comando Vermelho and Primeiro Comando da Capital, began as prison gangs in the late 1970s and early 90s, respectively. They've grown since to dominate the drug trade across South America, with money laundering operations sprawling into the far corners of Brazil's mainstream economy. Investigators recently found that both groups, burrowing deep into sectors such as fuel distribution, real estate, and finance, spawning fraud as they launder billions in drug profits. The terrorist designation for the gangs, previously announced in Washington and rejected by Brazil's government, opens the door for heavy U.S. sanctions, criminal probes, and civil liability, even for firms that deal indirectly with the groups. Asset freezes, banking restrictions, and greater regulatory scrutiny are also on the table, Brazilian law firm Pinheiro Neto Advogados said in a note. The U.S. policy internationalizes a risk that the Brazilian financial sector was already obligated to manage, said Rodrigo Caldas de Carvalho Borges, a partner at the law firm CBA Advogados. The most immediate impact will be a deepening of due diligence processes and higher demands from international partners. The risks and costs of compliance extend far beyond financial services. Few sectors of the Brazilian economy have escaped the gang's money laundering schemes. For example, a major police operation in August revealed a scheme moving some $10.3 billion through PCC-controlled gas stations and fuel distributors from 2020 to 2024. Another phase of the investigations found some $5 billion of money laundering over 4 years via fintechs and investment funds headquartered along the prestigious Avenida Faria Lima in Sao Paulo, the heart of Brazilian finance. Continuing with the business section, election betting will test prediction market rules. Experts warn of rising insider trading risks. This is from Washington. Prediction market watchdogs may struggle to police betting on the U.S. midterm elections, with thousands of races offering ever more ways for insiders to make a quick buck on the rising number of platforms, according to experts and new data. A surge in suspicious trades on Kalshi and Polymarket has stoked fears that these fast-growing markets are creating new avenues for insider trading. Kalshi in April suspended three congressional candidates for betting on their own races, and regulators are investigating whether former U.S. Representative George Santos engaged in potential insider trading on the platform. With at least 6,590 state and federal legislative seats up for election this year, an expected betting bonanza will test safeguards in a novel marketplace where insider trading remains a legally murky concept, and its regulator is stretched, the people said. we may see a slow response or we may see no response if and when insider trading happens in the midterms, said Ilya Balin, a professor at Seton Hall Law School who has studied prediction markets oversight. Suspicious trades would undermine Americans' faith in democracy at a time when polls show that many already worry that the system is in danger, he added. Kalshi, Polymarket, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the commodity derivatives regulator that is pushing for jurisdiction over prediction markets, say that they are equipped for the challenge with various monitoring tools and other resources. The platforms are also bolstering controls, with Kalshi blocking election trades by politicians and campaign workers and Polymarket cracking down on private information. In April, the U.S. Senate banned members and staff from prediction betting. Combined monthly global trading volumes on Kalshi and Polymarket surged fivefold from September to reach about $24 billion in April, compared with roughly $14 billion a month wagered through legal sports books in the United States last year, on average, according to Pew Research Center. As innovation expands the reach and complexity of our markets, we are continuing to grow alongside it, both operationally and technologically, a CFTC spokesperson said, adding that the agency will enforce the law aggressively. A lawyer for Santos declined to comment. Prediction markets allow traders to buy and sell binary yes or no contracts on the outcome of an array of events. In addition to roughly 470 congressional races, 6,122 state and territorial legislative seats are up for election this year, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, on top of local races for district attorney, mayor, the judiciary, and other offices. Each candidate generates insiders, campaign workers, pollsters, fundraisers, donors, friends, and family. While insider trading is banned in commodity derivative markets, there have been relatively few cases, said legal experts. And when it comes to elections, there is a smorgasbord of potentially relevant non-public information, from unpublished polling data to a brewing scandal, some of which may not be well understood by regulators, Balin said. They will need to learn, and that learning process often involves trial and error, he said. That pool of potential inside information is expanding as election bets become more esoteric. In 2024, a major election year, Polymarket listed 1,293 related markets with $7.26 billion in trading volume, according to the Anti-Corruption Data Collective, a nonprofit research group. With few major contests last year, the number of U.S. elections markets on Polymarket fell, but the ratio of markets to races rose sevenfold to 17.4, indicating election markets are becoming more granular, according to Michelle Kendler-Kretsch, an ACDC researcher. Increasingly, they focus less on the winners and losers and more on the variables of a race, such as voter turnout, margin of victory, and when candidates may drop out, according to ACDC's analysis, which has not previously been reported. That trend creates a more significant information asymmetry, while the number of potential insiders grows and the risk of insider trading increases, Kendler-Kretsch said. Besides Kalshi and Polymarket, there are at least four other U.S.-authorized platforms offering election contracts, a handful of brokers providing access to the products, and several other players hoping to launch. As with traditional markets, the companies are the first line of defense. Polymarket recently launched a U.S. operation, but its main exchange is not U.S.-regulated and has not generally mandated know-your-customer identity checks. While it bars U.S. residents, authorities have flagged concerns that these controls can be easily bypassed. Aside from KYC checks, Kalshi uses public records to identify federal politicians and campaign staffers before they trade, and plans to do the same for local elections where data is available. It also monitors trades for anomalies. As powerful as such tools are, each lead has to be investigated by humans, said Eitan Goldman, who was CFTC Enforcement Director from 2014 to 2017. With CFTC enforcement staffing at 105 positions, the agency may not have the staffing to probe a lot of referrals, Goldman said. The agency spokesman said it was relying on experienced personnel and had been hiring continuously since December. And the last item on the business section, New York Fed says inflation outlook persists. Survey reveals mixed views on the job market. The U.S. public's inflation outlook was little changed in May, despite the strong upward pressure on prices resulting from the war in the Middle East, a survey released by the New York Federal Reserve showed on June 8th. Inflation a year from now was expected to be 3.5% versus 3.6% in April, while respondents saw inflation 3 years and 5 years from now at 3.1% and 3.0%, respectively. While the projected path of price pressures was little changed in May, the regional Fed Bank survey found that uncertainty over future inflation rose over near-term measures amid rising anxiety about the current and future state of personal finances. The relative calm in inflation expectations will likely cheer U.S. central bank officials as they prepare for their June 16th and 17th policy meeting. The Fed is expected to leave its benchmark interest rate in the 3.50% to 3.75% range at that meeting, as officials wait for more data on the economic impact of the U.S.-backed war with Iran. The conflict has brought trade flows through the Strait of Hormuz to a near halt and caused a surge in gasoline prices, which in turn have driven headline measures of inflation higher. It's also causing notable supply chain disruptions, which could also add to inflation. The inflation outlook also has unsettled the monetary policy path. A number of Fed policymakers have begun to speculate that interest rates may need to rise to ensure the central bank's key inflation gauge, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, moves back to its 2% target. It reached 3.8% on a year-over-year basis in April. The case for rate hikes was bolstered on June 5th with the release of an unexpectedly strong employment report for May. The job market's vigor suggests a less challenging trade-off for Fed officials as they try to balance support for the labor market and the need to curtail inflation pressures. Fed officials have pointed to the relative stability of longer-run inflation expectations as a sign of public confidence that inflation will return to target, although data from the University of Michigan has suggested a less benign future for price pressures. If we see inflation expectations starting to migrate away from that 2% objective, that's a signal that this inflationary mindset may be setting in, Cleveland Fed President Beth Hammack said in a speech on June 2nd. I'm not seeing signs of that right now, she said, but it's something that I'm watching closely. The New York Fed survey showed that year ahead, expected rise in gasoline prices stood at 5% in May, down slightly from April. The year-ahead expected rate of home price growth jumped to 3.5% from 3% in April, marking the biggest reading since July 2022. And time now to turn to the sports section. Today's Arizona Republic, the big headline at the top of the page, Rodriguez among standouts who could be first-time All-Stars. There will be an infusion of new blood when Major League Baseball's All-Star Game descends upon Philadelphia next month. So many of the main characters and stalwarts from recent years, think Aaron Judge, Cal Raleigh, Tarik Skubal, Mookie Betts, have been slowed by injury or poor performance. Yet the show must go on, and unsurprisingly, a slew of players, some rookies, others very veteran, have stepped forward to replace them. Ready for an American League starting pitcher, Cam Schlittler? How about NL starting center fielder Michael Harris, the second? Sure, plenty can happen between now and early July when the full roster will be announced. Yet with fan voting now open, USA Today Sports examines 9 players on track to earn their first invites to the Midsummer Classic. Center fielder Andy Pages with the Dodgers. It's so very Dodgers that as they come under fire for all that's wrong with the game, good luck finding an MLB press release about the impending lockout that doesn't invoke their name, that their best player is making just $800,000. Okay, we'll allow that Shohei Ohtani, their best player. But nobody in the big leagues has produced 3.8 WAR without both pitching and hitting. With that in mind, behold Pages with 14 homers and 852 OPS, 5 outs above average defensively, and a trove of clutch at-bats that have kept the Dodgers atop the NL. It will be a typically large Dodgers contingent on hand, with the likes of Max Muncy and Justin Robleski as equally deserving as Freddie Freeman and Yoshinobu Yamamoto. But Pages will be flying the charter. And center fielder O'Neill Cruz with the Pirates. Remember this guy? Stands 6'7", is slated to be Pittsburgh's answer to Ellie De La Cruz as a massive and massively talented shortstop before he was relegated to the outfield. Well, Cruz is more than justifying the great expectations heralding his arrival. The big fella is on pace for a 30-homer, 40-steal season, and with his long levers and elite bat speed, ranks in the 100th percentile for both average exit velocity at 96.4 miles per hour and hard hit rate, 59.2%. Sure, the big hacks and larger strike zone have resulted in majors leading 98 strikeouts, and he's a below average center fielder. Shea Langeliers from the Athletics. Just a remarkably steady climb for a player who endured a trade from Atlanta and a move down I-80 to Yolo County in his first few seasons with the A's. Langeliers leads AL catchers in home runs, 16, OPS, it's .880, and average, .281, all while handling an inexperienced pitching staff that's already deployed 10 starters this season. And right-handed pitcher Nick Martinez from the Rays. Perhaps this will be the winter that Martinez receives a multi-year contract after 2 seasons of accepting the qualifying offer from Cincinnati and then a 1-year $13 million deal with Tampa Bay. It was once again a shrewd pitching investment for the Rays. Martinez is second to Schlittler in the AL with a 2.29 ERA and has given up 2 or fewer runs in 11 of his 12 starts. And then there's second baseman Ernie Clement from the Blue Jays. It's tempting to call this a 12-month All-Star nod, piggybacking off Clement's excellent 2025, followed by his record-setting 30-hit postseason. But let's check the tape. Clement leads the AL with 77 hits, ranks 5th in the majors with a .306 average, and 1st with 19 doubles, and naturally leads all AL second basemen in almost every meaningful statistical category. He remains an excellent defensive second baseman while filling in at shortstop against left-handers, and should piggyback his eye-opening World Baseball Classic nod by joining this AL super team. Next is left-hand pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez with the Diamondbacks. Wait a minute, Rodriguez, a World Series champion with Cy Young Award votes on his resume, has never been an All-Star? Perhaps that's about to change. It's been an injury and illness-laden journey for Rodriguez, who's 33, the past 6 seasons, but he's absolutely found his groove in Arizona, where he's 5th in an overly loaded NL ERA race and has posted 3 starts of 7 innings and no earned runs. And infielder offense Casey Schmidt for the Giants. Wow, what a disappointing season for the Giants. Yet Schmidt has been a consistent power source through it all, with 15 homers, 28 extra base hits, and an .868 OPS. It's been a most pleasant surprise for a guy who has never been able to solidify a position nor play 100 games in a season. Now he's forced the issue, even as top prospect Bryce Eldridge has arrived and Rafael Devers has started producing. An everyday player and the Giants' best representative in Philly. And outfielder Brandon Marsh of the Phillies. Speaking of Philly, it will be interesting to see how engaged the hometown fan base is at the virtual ballot box, with longtime faves Bryce Harper and Kyle Schwarber both worthy of selection. And though Schwarber has a more viable case, he's blocked in fan balloting at DH by Otani. Amid all that, let's not forget about Marsh, whose damp mane and thick beard are familiar to fans after four straight playoff appearances. The dude leads the majors in batting .338, is OPSing .889, and for a while was the only guy keeping the Phillies afloat as manager Ron Thompson got fired and others struggled. And second baseman Bryce Terang from the Brewers. Yet another, wait, hasn't he been an all-star yet? Nope, that was the World Baseball Classic. We saw Terang taking a star turn and emerging as one of the most respected ballplayers on that vaunted Team USA squad. Now he and the Brewers are at it again. The eternal surprises in the NL Central are 39-23, and Terang leads them with a 3.0 WAR with 9 homers and 11 steals. He's creeping toward a 30-30 season, and his 881 OPS leads all major league second basemen. And turning to basketball, Wemby and Spurs defeat Knicks in Game 3. The San Antonio Spurs have some life in them. Facing a 3-0 hole in the 2026 NBA Finals, the Spurs withstood a late charge from the Knicks on Monday, June 8th, to claim their first victory in the series, 115-111, snapping New York's 13-game playoff winning streak. And now, with Game 4 in the sights, we officially have a series. San Antonio played with urgency and desperation from the start of the game, swarming the Knicks on defense and forcing them into turnovers and contested possessions. But it was star phenom Victor Wembanyama who carried San Antonio, leading the Spurs with 32 points, 8 rebounds, 6 assists, and 3 blocks. The Spurs, though, did have 6 players reach double figures in scoring. This came on a night when exorbitant ticket prices made this the most expensive NBA Finals game on record. And President Donald J. Trump also attended as a guest of Knicks owner James Dolan. Here are live takeaways from Game 3 of the NBA Finals between the New York Knicks and San Antonio Spurs. The biggest issue for the Knicks tonight has been turnovers. The Knicks, by and large, have played pretty well. They're beating the Spurs on the break. They're outworking them on the offensive glass for second-chance points. The main reason the Spurs are hanging around, however, is ball protection. Through three quarters, the Knicks committed 11 turnovers, compared to just 6 from the Spurs. But that's just one part of the problem. San Antonio turned those plays into 19 points through three quarters, while New York made up just 5 points off the Spurs' giveaways. The turnovers had stalled New York's offense somewhat, and it's prevented the Knicks from stacking quality possessions in the second half. The Spurs came out with the desperate energy of a team on the brink. It took a quarter, but New York eventually matched that. Through the first several minutes of the game, it was San Antonio that dictated the pace and flow of the game. The Spurs were playing with more speed and defensive intensity, forcing the Knicks into turnovers in 2 of their first 3 possessions. New York, perhaps playing with some subconscious complacency, started rather sluggishly, missing 2 of its first 6 shots. Yet the Knicks emerged in the second quarter with some urgency of their own and launched an 11-2 run early in the period. It didn't end there either. The Knicks outscored San Antonio by 18 in the quarter and closed the half on a 14-3 run. For the Knicks, it was defense that sparked the runs. They used their length and athleticism to make drives difficult. And then, once the Spurs crept toward the paint, New York did a better job of collapsing on the defense. The Spurs shot just 9 of 20, 45% from the field in the second quarter, compared to New York's blistering 14 of 19, 73.7% period. Not surprisingly, that defense turned into fast break opportunities, with the Knicks claiming a 9-0 edge in the stat at the half. After settling for too many jumpers in games 1 and 2, San Antonio attacked the paint. New York adjusted. The Spurs very clearly did not want to leave things to chance. After coach Mitch Johnson had defended his team's shot selection in the first two games of the series, bemoaning open looks that simply didn't drop, the Spurs got to work down low Monday night. And it started with Victor Wembanyama, whose first four shot attempts were in the paint, with three of those coming at the rim. It wasn't only Wembanyama. The Spurs constantly attacked the paint, asking guards De'Aaron Fox, Stephen Castle, and Dylan Harpers to wriggle and slash past defenders to finish at the rim. And it paid off. After scoring just 22 points in the paint in the first half of Game 2, the Spurs dropped 28 down low in the first half of Game 3. The problem was that 16 of those came in the first quarter. For the Spurs to have a chance to steal this game, not only will they need to be intentional about their attacks into the paint, they need to convert them when they got good looks. For the Spurs, it's been the Wembanyama and Castle show. They need more help. In the first half, Victor Wembanyama and Stephen Castle combined to score 33 points on 13 of 19 shooting at 68.4%. The rest of the Spurs didn't necessarily shoot poorly as much as they weren't able to create their own looks as easily. Put another way, Wembanyama and Castle combined for 57.9% of San Antonio's first half points, and as defenders started top pressure, Wembanyama and Castle more, forcing the ball out of their hands, other Spurs didn't step up. The biggest factor here is De'Aaron Fox, who scored just 4 points on 2 of 6 shooting in the half, although he did dish 5 assists. And the Diamondbacks are playing the Marlins today. That'll be on at 3:40 p.m. on Cox Channel 34. They'll be playing at Lone Depot Park. Nelson has shown signs of consistency with at least 7 innings of work in 4 of his past 5 starts. However, he has given up 15 home runs after allowing just 17 all of last season and 17 the year before. Nelson gave up a run on 5 hits in 6 innings in his only career start against the Marlins. And coming up on Thursday, tomorrow, they'll be at Miami. The game will be shown at 10:10 a.m. Right-handed pitcher Merrill Kelly versus Marlins right-handed pitcher Tyler Phillips. On Friday, they'll be in Cincinnati, 4:15 p.m. game. Diamondbacks left-handed pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez versus Reds to be announced. And on Saturday, they're at Cincinnati again. It's a 1:10 game. Diamondbacks right-handed pitcher Michael Soroka versus Reds left-handed pitcher Andrew Abbott. And before we leave the sports section, take a look at the sports in brief. Donovan urges U.S. to seize home World Cup moment. Former United States captain Landon Donovan said success for the U.S. team at the home World Cup should be measured both by results and by the kind of iconic moments that can accelerate soccer's growth in the country. Donovan, whose stoppage time winner against Algeria at the 2010 World Cup sent the U.S. into the knockout stage, and remains one of the most celebrated goals in American soccer history, said expectations should be high for the co-hosts. For our team, the expectations are you have to get out of the group, Donovan told Reuters in an interview while promoting his partnership with Nestle. I think in this case, a home World Cup with a very favorable group, the expectation should be that we win the group, he said. When you win the group, you allow yourself a much easier path to get a deep run into the tournament. And report, Chiefs reunite with C.B. Sneed on a 1-year deal. Veteran cornerback L'Jarius Sneed won 2 Super Bowl rings with Kansas City Chiefs. Now he's back to try to earn a third. Sneed is back in Kansas City on a 1-year contract worth up to $5 million, ESPN reported Monday. Snead spent the first 4 years of his NFL career with the Chiefs before being traded to the Tennessee Titans in the spring of 2024. But he failed to make an impact in Tennessee, where he played just 12 games over 2 seasons with 0 interceptions. The Titans released Snead on March 13th, which saved about $11.4 million in cap space. In Kansas City, Snead amassed 10 interceptions, 6.5 sacks, and 40 pass breakups over 57 games with 54 starts. He made 13 playoff starts in those 4 years. Snead won't see many familiar faces in Kansas City's cornerbacks room. After signing Cade Kohu and Kair Elam as free agents during the offseason, the Chiefs drafted Mansoor Delane with the 6th overall pick in April. Delane signed a 4-year, $41.9 million contract on Monday. And Somali soccer referee is denied U.S. entry and will miss the World Cup debut. The United States denied entry over the weekend to soccer referee Omar Abdulkadir Artan, who had been expected to be the first Somali to officiate at a World Cup match. A FIFA spokesperson said on Monday that Artan will not be able to train and officiate at the World Cup after he was not allowed to enter the United States. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. And now time to take a look at the opinion section from today's Arizona Republic. The first opinion, LDS not Christian in new military list is offensive. This is written by Trevor Nelson for the Arizona Republic. Recently, the Department of Defense restructured its official list of recognized religious affiliations used by military chaplains. The department reduced the list from more than 200 categories to 31. The stated reason was administrative efficiency. The actual result is something far more significant and far more dangerous. For the first time in American history, the federal government has created an official designation of which faiths are Christian and which are not. Previously, faiths were listed by name and by code. No government document drew a line between Christian and non-Christian. That line did not exist. It does now. Why did the Pentagon make the recognized religion change? The new list labels 21 faiths as Christian. Among them, Catholic, Baptist, Orthodox Christian, and Jehovah's Witnesses. Not among them, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, with its 17 million members worldwide, and with deep roots across Arizona. Also not among them, many faith traditions practiced by American service members. More faiths are off this list than on it. Utah's congressional delegation responded swiftly, calling the exclusion of their church unacceptable and demanding correction. Their frustration is understandable, but the outrage is aimed at the wrong target. The problem is not that the LDS Church was left off the Christian list. The problem is that the government created a Christian list at all. That is not the government's business. It has never been the government's business. The moment we accept that it is, even to correct an exclusion we find offensive, we have conceded the very principle of the Constitution that the Constitution was written to protect. Article 6 of the Constitution states plainly that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification for any office or public trust. The First Amendment places religious freedom first among the 5 freedoms it protects. Before speech, before press, before assembly, before petition. These were not accidents of drafting. They were deliberate decisions made by men who had lived under governments that drew exactly these kinds of lines. What are the consequences of this change? Thomas Nelson, Jr. signed the Declaration of Independence, served as governor of Virginia, and spent his personal fortune financing the Continental Army, dying in poverty because of it. At Yorktown, he ordered cannon fire directed at his own home because British troops had occupied it. He came home from his education in England having watched the Church of England decide which faiths were legitimate and which were not. He built something specifically designed to prevent that architecture from taking root here. He is my ancestor. He did not give everything he had to build. What just happened? There is a detail that the congressional response has not fully addressed. The Secretary of Defense's own church is among the evangelical traditions that theologically reject the LDS Church's claim to Christianity. That makes the omission difficult to dismiss as bureaucratic oversight. But even if the intent were purely administrative, the result is the same. A government document now tells military chaplains which faiths count as Christian. That is a religious test. The Constitution forbids it, regardless of intent. What does the change have on Arizona LDS military members and veterans? It's worth noting that before the controversy erupted, the first presidency of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had already called its global membership to a worldwide fast on July 5th to pray for the strengthening of religious liberty worldwide. That call was not reactive. Religious freedom is not a Latter-day Saint issue or a Christian issue. It is a human issue. This should concern every Arizonan, regardless of faith. A government empowered to draw this line for one tradition has established the machinery to draw it for any tradition. The question is not whether your faith made the Christian list this time. The question is whether you want the government to make that list at all. The Constitution does not say some flesh. It does not say Christian flesh. It says no religious test. It means what it says. This was written by Trevor Nelson for The Republic. He is a direct descendant of Thomas Nelson, Jr., signer of the Declaration of Independence and a Scottsdale resident. He writes the Won't Fix Report on Substack. The next opinion is written by Miles Pollard and Christopher Lynch for The Republic. Arizona can lead in protecting us from foreign fraud. Washington may lead the foreign policy, but the vulnerabilities that China exploits often sit at the state level. You've heard the acronym FAFO, but a lesser known and more family-friendly version, Foreign Adversary Fraud Offices, would empower states to counter such exploitations and mitigate vulnerabilities. Arizona's SB 1308 would establish an FAFO within the existing Arizona Attorney General's office. This office would be authorized to bring legal claims against foreign entities suspected of violating American consumer fraud laws when marketing, distributing, or selling technology produced by a foreign adversary. So, if a Chinese-linked entity is buying up farmland around military bases or selling components to solar installations that may be sending data and cyber access back to China, the FAFO office can deliver due justice. How would the office be funded? Such an office does not need to break the bank. SB 1308 appropriates $500,000 for the office's fraud fund in fiscal year 2026-27 for a general use fund for staffing and litigation costs. To plug any state-level vulnerabilities, any money won in litigation above $10 million at year's end would be transferred into a foreign adversary technology rip and replace fund. This secondary fund would pay for replacing foreign adversary technology from critical infrastructure, including oil, gas systems, water systems, electrical power delivery, telecommunications, networks, transportation systems, emergency services, and personal data storage systems. While procurement bans are often are important for national security reasons, they are often symbolic without effective enforcement measures and proper financing vehicles for their replacement. The linking of investigations, litigation, and prudent solution financing solves these issues elegantly from a policy perspective. Why would Arizona need a foreign adversary office? The case for such an FAFO program is not theoretical. The Department of Commerce's foreign adversary list includes China, Hong Kong, Macau, along with Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Russia, for a variety of national security reasons. Meanwhile, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, known as CISA, and partner agencies warned in 2024 that the Chinese state-sponsored actors known as Volt Typhoon had compromised IT environments across multiple U.S. critical infrastructure sectors. Volt Typhoon's efforts were the latest in a long-running campaign of cyber attacks from China. These espionage targets included telecommunications, energy, transportation, water, and waste management systems. Arizona's proposal also fits a broader national trend. In a recent Heritage Foundation paper, our scholars cataloged recent state laws on China across 11 policy categories, including land ownership, procurement, app restrictions, divestment, genomic data, education, foreign gift reporting, lobbying, sister city relationships, organ harvesting, and transnational repression. We found that these laws seem to be passed along partisan lines, which chiefly states that voted for Donald Trump in the 2024 election having passed such laws. While dozens of states passed foreign land ownership and procurement restrictions on Chinese goods, far fewer states had acted on lobbying, foreign gift reporting, transnational repression, or sister city relationships. Arizona's legislation is a model for the rest of the country. That gap matters because China's strategy is far from one-dimensional. Beijing does not focus on a single method or leverage or infiltrate only one control system. The fear is that our adversaries could leverage these ties, allowing their affiliated agent to have enough footholds in enough sensitive systems to create a crisis point. A compromised router, a tainted procurement chain, a vulnerable water utility, or a data system tied to foreign adversary technology can become a strategic liability. More states should emulate Arizona's model legislation, but they should also strengthen it. A durable FAFO framework should include a dedicated unit within state attorneys' general offices, a required inventory of foreign adversary technology in critical infrastructure, an authority to pursue civil enforcement under state consumer fraud law, a dedicated rip and replace fund, and annual public reporting that protects sensitive security information while prudently informing lawmakers and the public where the risks remain. The approach avoids two common errors. It does not pretend that every Chinese-made product is automatically a crisis, but it also refuses to pretend that economic cost savings are real savings when they import surveillance, sabotage, or coercion risk into the public infrastructure. Washington has a role to play, but states often control important systems like infrastructure, universities, and public data. Strategic competition with China won't be won in theory or diplomacy alone. It will be won, or lost, through mitigating those vulnerabilities. Arizona's FAFO proposal recognizes that reality, and other states should follow. Otherwise, states risk learning the hard way what FAFO really means. And that opinion was written by Miles Pollard, a policy analyst for the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and Christopher Lynch, a member of Heritage's Young Leaders Program. And time now for the horoscopes for today, Wednesday, June 10th. If you're an Aries, born between March 21st and April 19th, you're avoiding someone, or they're avoiding you, as Mercury and Saturn square off. And for Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, making a big deal over it? As Mercury and Saturn clash, assuming the worst exacerbates an imaginary problem. And for Gemini, born May 21st to June 21st, feeling chronically misunderstood? The more you try to communicate your concerns, the less others seem to acknowledge you. For Cancer, born between June 22nd and July 22nd, the more you try to share your expertise, the more others withdraw as Mercury and Saturn clash. And for Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, refusing to let go of a grudge, you've got an axe to grind as Mercury and Saturn clash. For Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, trying to maintain the upper hand in a relationship, consider the cost as Mercury and Saturn square off. And for Libra, born September 23rd to October 23rd, don't want to be judged? Stop judging others then. Mercury's clash with Saturn won't let you have it both ways. And for Scorpio, born between October 24th and November 21st, are you falling behind? Step back and examine what is truly unfinished. For Sagittarius, born between November 22nd and December 21st, casting blame, your lack of confidence has you judging someone unfairly as Mercury clashes with Saturn. And for Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, making accusations, beware. You may have the wrong picture of a partner's intentions as Mercury and Saturn clash. And for Aquarius, born between January 20th and February 18th, work smarter, not harder. As Mercury and Saturn clash, you want others to recognize your output, but that's not what counts. And finally for Pisces, February 19th through March 20th, stop with the negative self-talk. Mercury's clash with Saturn finds you downplaying your talents and credentials. And now to Dear Abby. Dear Abby, I've been married to my wife for 2 years. We met online and have known each other for about 5 years. We originally lived an hour apart, and after some persuasion, we bought a condo together. Everything was going great until I began to notice my wife's attraction to other women. I noticed lesbians cruising my wife wherever we went, whether we were on vacation or just at the grocery store. I also believe she's finding women online and having sex with them. I don't think she's gay, but just enjoys the sex part. Also, she still has sex with me. I hate the fact that all this is done in secret. She denies anything is happening, but I've caught her in many lies. We're retired and living off both our savings, but most of it's hers. I don't know if I could survive just on my savings. She's also threatened to take a lot of my savings through litigation. I'm stuck. I love her, but I can't continue this farce. Help, please. Signed, Nervous in New England. Dear Nervous, your wife may not be gay, but if your hunch is accurate, she is certainly bisexual. However, you have more problems than her having sex outside your marriage. Equally troubling are her threats to help herself to your savings, and the fact that when you ask her something, you don't necessarily get a straight answer. You may love your wife, but I don't see how you can stay married and be happy under these conditions. You should consider whether you are at risk for an STD. You may need to talk about this with a lawyer. One more thing. You stated that you are afraid you can't survive financially if you leave her. Because you both invested in the condo, wouldn't you be entitled to half the money from the sale? Think about how you were managing to survive before you met her, and consider whether you can live that way again. And dear Abby, I'm in love with a married woman. I was in love with her many years ago, before she was married, and she knew I was in love with her, but she lied to me and led me on. Despite knowing how I felt about her, she got married, leaving me devastated. Now, many years later, I'm still in mourning and haunted by what if. I know I can never move on from her, and it seems like things will never change. So what do I do? Signed, Abandoned in Arizona. Dear Abandoned, when I was young, I was in love with Steve Reeves and Robert Redford, not at the same time, though. Unfortunately, they were both taken, and not with me. If you want to waste any more of your life pining after a woman who lied to you, led you on, and married someone else, that is your privilege. If, however, you'd like to get beyond your lingering emotional pain, you will ask your physician or insurance company for the name of a licensed psychologist. You can move on, but it will require concerted effort. And if you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can contact her at www.dearabby.com. And we have time for some comics. We'll start with Blondie. Dagwood is at his front door talking to his mailman. And he says, "Gosh, the way things are going, do you worry about robots replacing your job?" And the mailman says, "Not at all. In fact, I was just having this very conversation earlier with someone who really gets it." Dagwood said, "Who's that?" And the mailman says, "ChatGPT." In Peanuts, Linus is sitting with his blanket and Lucy just grabs it from him. And she says, he says, "Hey, my blanket." She says, "I need it. What if we have a late freeze tonight? I need your blanket to cover my plants." And the last frame shows Linus sitting outside in the dark next to a plant covered by the blanket. And he says, "This is the first time in my life I've ever sat up all night with a parsnip." In Pickles, little Nelson is sitting on the arm of the chair that his grandfather is sitting in. And he says, "Maybe you should carry a little notebook in your pocket, Grandpa. Then, when you get a good idea, you can write it there instead of on your hand." "I'm impressed, Nelson. That's a very good idea." And he pulls out his pen and writes it on his hand. In The Born Loser, it's looks like it's breakfast time. His wife's got a cup of coffee getting up, and he's got a pencil and paper. And she looks at him and says, "Ah, they say word puzzles promote good brain health." And Thornapple says, "Well, that may be, but they sure don't help my ego's health." In Pearls Before Swine, there's a little stand that someone's standing behind in a devil's outfit. It's got horns and a pitchfork. And there's a sign that says Santa's Helper. And the devil costume guy says, "Hi, welcome to hell." She says, "Hell? What did I do to deserve this?" Unnecessarily replying thanks or great to every single person on a group email or text. That can get you to hell? The devil says, "Surely you didn't think you people went to heaven." And then he says, "It's sad when I have to explain that." And we have a little time left. Take a look at things that happened today in history. Today is June 10th. On this date, in 1898, U.S. Marines landed at Guantanamo Bay, part of a war in Cuba that led to the end of Spanish colonization in the Americas. On this date in 1963, President John Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act, which amended the Fair Labor Standards Act. It aimed to eliminate the pay gap between men and women by prohibiting wage discrimination based on gender. And on this day in 1967, Israel signed a ceasefire agreement to end the Six-Day War as the victor. And on this date in 2003, NASA's Mars Exploration Rover mission began with the launching of the Spirit Rover. And on this date in 2016, thousands of dignitaries, celebrities, and fans converged on Louisville, Kentucky to remember the life of the late boxer Muhammad Ali. And on this date in 2020, the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in the United States surpassed 2 million. Wow. And we'll finish up with some celebrity birthdays. Singer Shirley Owens from the Shirelles turns 85 today. Politician lawyer John Edwards turns 73. Comedian actor Rich Hall is 72 today. Guitarist songwriter Ernie C. from Body Count is 67. Bassist Kim Deal from the Pixies is 65. Actor Gina Gershon is 67 today. Model actor Elizabeth Hurley is 61 today. And Joey Santiago from the Pixies, guitarist, is 61 today. Singer Eric Rutan from Cannibal Corpse is 55 today. Businessman Sundar Pichai, 54 today. Singer-actor Faith Evans is 53 today. Rapper Flesh and Bone from the Bone Thugs and Harmony is 53 today. Actor Lily Sobieski is 43 today. And actor-model Kate Upton is 34 today. And before we leave, the Republic would like to know what America's 250th anniversary means to you. The United States of America is turning 250 years old this July, and the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com want to know what that means to you. Between now and June 21st, we're looking for your thoughts on the significance of this milestone. Answers will be published in the Sunday, June 28th Viewpoints section and online in the days leading up to July 4th. Select one of these topics and tell us what you think. What does the 250th anniversary of the nation's founding mean to you? What do you think the next 250 years could look like for the country? What makes you uniquely proud to be an American? And what will Arizona's role in the next 250 years entail? If you have thoughts on all four, feel free to write a separate entry on each topic. Each submission will be reviewed and considered for publication in the Sunday, June 28th Viewpoints section. All letters must be verified prior to publication. We don't publish anonymous letters. Letters to the editor submitted to the Republic may be published or distributed in print, electronic, or other formats. Subject matter should be relevant to readers, provocative, constructive, and timely. Passion is good. So is humor. And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.